25 miles per hour. Some gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Very windy right now. It's a cold wind. Northwesterly, 16, gusting to 38. 20 degrees Kenosha, 18 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, we're going to be hearing about an interesting cabaret program called I Wanna Fly that's going to be presented under the auspices of the Milwaukee Opera Theater. We'll be hearing from the singer who is in the spotlight for that cabaret. But we begin with Brian Gill, Associate Professor of Theater Arts at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, who's been on the morning show any number of times and today is here to talk about the latest play opening at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in its Black Box Theater. And this is a play by a playwright that most of us have at least heard of, Henrik Ibsen, but a play that I dare say probably none of us have ever actually seen, a play called When We Dead Awaken. And I'm trying to remember, I think someplace I saw that this was his last play?
Yes.
Or one of his
yes,
last plays.
He died fairly soon after completing this one.
So anyway, this is a rare opportunity in more ways than one to experience a profoundly fascinating drama by Henrik Ibsen. We're going to be talking about him and about this play, how it showed up on the Parkside season, and what kind of challenges it has represented for Brian Gill and his cast. The performances of When We Dead Awaken by Ibsen will be this coming weekend, March 1st, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and March 8th, 9th, and 10th. And as we said before, it will be in Parkside's beautiful Black Box Theater. Brian Gill, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
So glad we can have this conversation, and it's going to be really fun to learn a little more about Henrik Ibsen. And I was realizing that I know this name just because of Edvard Grieg's Peer Gynt, you know, really famous orchestral work, incidental music to his drama Peer Gynt, but I couldn't tell you what Peer Gynt is about, and I could hardly tell you anything at all about Ibsen. In fact, I could only guess that he was Norwegian. I wasn't absolutely certain of that until I actually looked that up this morning. So it just makes me realize, oh my gosh, I know this guy was important, and yet somehow we have not sort of collectively paid enough attention to him. That is the general public. Obviously, those of you who are in the world of theater understand Henrik Ibsen's significance a whole lot more than we do. Could we just start there with who Henrik Ibsen was and what makes him such a towering figure in theatrical history?
Absolutely. Yeah. Ibsen really upended theater. He's considered the father of early modern realism. So he took what was, you know, very melodramatic and very presentational and suddenly was dealing with more realistic sets and terrifying his audiences by dealing with taboo subject matter. You know, he wrote about religious hypocrisy and hypocrisy in general, the marriage inequality. He even took on sexually transmitted disease in one of his plays called Ghosts. So he was kind of the terrifying, dirty old man of the theater who was airing all of humanity's secrets in public. And it's hard for us to think about it in these terms now, but it was totally revolutionary.
Wow, daring, it sounds like,
yeah,
in a lot
absolutely,
of ways.
Absolutely. I mean, riot inspiring. and when these plays made it to the UK and to Europe, they essentially went underground. They were performed kind of, you know, show up at you know, the such and such space at 9 o'clock and watch this play. And early on, that was the only way you could get a copy of the play. So it was this, you know, I mean, as we continue to learn, unfortunately, the quickest way to get people interested in subject matter is to forbid it or ban it. And, you know, the people would go see these plays kind of, you know, there's these dirty little secrets, this underground kind of scene, and then they could purchase a copy of the play there and be scandalous. And
wow.
But yeah, it's so he's a fascinating character and a brilliant playwright.
Hmm. I wrote down his dates and now I can't find them. Oh yes, 1828 to 1906.
Yes.
So a long life and casting a very tall shadow over theatrical history. So I took down a couple of names of some of his significant dramas. Peer Gynt, of course, I've already mentioned. You mentioned Ghosts. I've seen, actually, I think, A Doll's House, mm-hmm. or some variation on that, and I think that's one of his more often performed plays.
Exactly.
Another one that looks like the title is Brand, B-R-A-N-D.
Yes.
Hedda Gabler.
Hedda Gabler,
which I've seen that title before. So I read that Ibsen, when you... total performances all around the world, is second only to Shakespeare as a dramatist in terms of the number of performances that occur. So even if maybe here in America, you know, he doesn't show up all that often on the marquee, when we look the world over, Ibsen is maybe better understood and appreciated.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think so. And structurally, you know, there is an argument that he was a better playwright than Shakespeare.
Wow.
Just in how he constructed. I mean, completely different styles of theater, right? But he was. I'm a big Ibsen fan, and everyone, you know, when you talk about Ibsen, oftentimes, or at least when I talk about Ibsen, I'll get, you know, the usual reaction is kind of an eye roll and, oh, Ibsen. And everyone seems to think they know what an Ibsen play is when they have no idea what. You know, I mean, it's similar to Shakespeare, right? If you see a really good production of Shakespeare, you get it and it's fun. And if you don't see a very good production of Shakespeare, you don't get it and it's a punishment.
Wow.
You know, so and my experiences with Ibsen are the same thing. I mean, these are up to the minute modern plays, even though they were written, you know, decades and decades and decades ago.
Yeah, well, more than a century ago, in every instance. So did you have anything to do with When We Dead Awaken showing up in this school year's docket of plays at Parkside?
Well, we decided it was time, the faculty decided it was time to produce a classical play, you know, and then all eyes looked over to me. And
are you the classical guy?
I guess I am the classical guy.
Okay.
And so we talked about Ibsen, and we have a student committee that's involved in play selection.
Oh.
So we will you know, if it's, for example, if it's a Shakespeare, we'll say, hey, we're going to do a Shakespeare in this upcoming season. It's going to be a comedy. Give us three suggestions that you think the students would be interested in. So we did a similar plan with Ibsen, fully expecting that they would come back to us with A Doll's House, which is arguably his best-known play. And they pulled a fast one on us, because these students came back with two of the more obscure plays. So John Gabriel Borkman, which I was like, what? And then When We Dead Awaken, and then Ghosts. But they were most excited about When We Dead Awaken, because the play itself is such a massive change from a playwriting point of view. He went in a completely different direction. And it was awesome to see our students so excited about this, you know, this play that they probably had to blow dust off of when they when they found a copy of it, and I was really struck with that, and I thought, okay, well, you know, if we've got that level of buy-in from the students and they're excited about this play written in 1899, let's do this.
Wow. Maybe this is too personal or direct a question to ask you, but when they said When We Dead Awaken, I mean, like, did you immediately know what they were talking about? I mean, like, could you have in that moment said what this play is about, or is it one of those plays that you learn about a long time ago and then, but nobody does it, so
right.
That recedes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I thought, okay, well, I've heard of that play. I know it's his last play. I know that it's very different from, in some ways, it's very different from his other works. And I thought, okay, well, that's, you know, first thing I need to do is, because Ghosts I know very well. And, you know, so I thought, okay, well, I need to, now that they've given us these three options, I don't need to worry about Ghosts, but I need to look at these other plays.
Right.
And, but yeah, it was their level of excitement. Of just this kind of, oh my God, and then this happens, and then we saw this, and then, and, oh, you know, and I thought, oh my God, these, you know, they're excited about this play.
And from reading the script.
Yeah.
I mean, not
yeah,
from having,
exactly.
not from having seen
not
it.
Not from having seen it. Having just read the script, they were really excited about it.
Wow.
So, you know, how can you say no?
That would be very tough to say no to that. For those of you just joining us, I'm talking today with Brian Gill, Associate Professor of Theater Arts at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and the director of their next theatrical production, which is Henrik Ibsen's When We Dead Awaken, his last drama. And a work very, very unconventional. I mean, at least to my amateur eye, I was just really, the more I read the synopsis, the more shocked I became. Not shocked, that's kind of the wrong word. Although maybe in a couple plot points, it's a little shocking, some of the turns that it takes. Brian, I mentioned before we went on the air that I recently did an interview with the director of a production at the Racine Theater Guild, and it's a play that has kind of a big secret, actually several of them, and so we had to be so guarded in the way that we talked about the play that we ended up barely being able to talk about the plot of the play at all for fear of giving something away that really, admittedly, is better experienced by the audience.
Absolutely.
Not hearing about it first. So I was relieved to see that your poster or whatever of When We Dead Awaken spells out a lot of the plot.
Yes,
I mean,
full,
right to the
full transparency.
Yeah, right to the final avalanche and so on. And you were kind of explaining it to me, but explain to our listeners kind of why you are laying it all out. I mean, right at the outset.
Sure. This play is really different from his other plays. It's 90 minutes. So it's kind of a freight train. Once it gets started, it just keeps going. The entire play takes place outside, which is very different from his other plays, which usually take place in a room or two, inside somebody's house, generally speaking. And it deals with interesting characters. The lead character is an artist who became famous because of his sculpture called Resurrection Day, and years later he is reunited with his model and muse who worked with him on that sculpture, who vanished before he finished the sculpture, and she approaches him and tells him that essentially she believes that in creating the sculpture Resurrection Day, he took her soul and put it into the sculpture, and in so doing, killed her. So she is a disturbed character who is kind of wanders around the earth, kind of glides through the world.
Kind of a walking ghost.
Yeah, followed by a very sinister nun, because, of course. And they're reunited, and one of the things they talk about regularly in the play is this desire to ascend the mountains so that they can observe all the glory of the world. And they finally get there, and Irene and Rubek and they ascend the mountain and are completely wiped out by an avalanche.
Mm. As happens.
as is the case oftentimes.
Wow.
And that is spoilers, that is the end of the play. The two characters are killed by an avalanche.
Right. Well, and maybe, you know, I said the word shocking and then I pulled away from it, and now kind of the more I think about it, maybe shocking is the perfect word, because I mean actually it just feels like such an unconventional story. And you go to the next paragraph and what?
Yeah.
And then to the next paragraph and what?
Yes.
I mean, again and again and again. I mean, and I suppose maybe part of what's important to say is that Ibsen emerges, I'm guessing, at a time when theater in general, at least, was really locked in conventionality and predictability. And so, I mean, in a sense, one can well imagine a figure like Ibsen being just necessary, to breathe life into something.
And things were starting to change, you know, from the strict rules of modernism and then into naturalism, and you know, with Strindberg's work, things started to shift into, you know, being a bit more odd and being a bit more theatrical. And I think Ibsen saw the writing on the wall and also wanted to explore that himself.
Hmm. That touches on something I wanted to ask you, which is you called him the father of modern realism,
modern realism,
I think.
Yep.
Of course, the thing that's odd in, as you've described this plot, is it doesn't seem like an example of realism
right.
at all.
Yeah.
So are you saying by this point in his career he had discarded realism or a more standard idea of what realism is? Or is this using the term realism in a way that we don't usually use it?
It seems like he was exploring. You know, there was some assumption or some belief that had he lived, he suffered a series of strokes after he wrote this play, and then one major stroke that he was then unable to write any longer. Mm. But there seems to be some evidence that this was going to be kind of his epilogue, his kind of final chapter of a new kind of play. Mm. And you know, and so what did the old man have planned post When We Dead Awaken? But no matter the play, I always approach the work from a realistic point of view, and I think part of that is that's the style we are used to. You know, even if it's the most off the wall surrealistic film that we see, the acting is still very realistic, very natural, you know, very naturalistic. Partly because that lends itself best to the camera and to film. But so even though this play gets wonderfully odd at places, I really encouraged and directed it, you know, encouraged the actors to be real, treat it real. Because I think the one major pitfall for this play, because it is odd and I mean that in a wonderful way and very, very interesting, and if we tipped into melodrama, I knew we would be doomed.
Mm.
So the level of realism in the performances was very important to me, that these actors play it real, play it honest, okay. Even though there is, you know, a wonderful scene by the river where they're kind of reliving some memories and throwing flowers into the stream and all this kind of stuff. We didn't want to tip into making it, you know, melodramatic and overly sweet and then the adventure up into the mountains, and you know, this really could have tipped into that melodramatic kind of, you know, I can't pay the rent, you must pay the rent, you know, kind of plot, you know, which I wasn't interested in.
Yeah. Explain the choice to put this in the Black Box Theater.
I adore the Black Box and have not directed in there for 3 years. So part of it was pure selfishness.
Okay. I think of you as a selfish person, Brian, so that's no surprise at all.
It's such a beautiful and wonderful space. We're incredibly fortunate at Parkside to have that state-of-the-art Black Box Theater. But it's also a wonderful space to do. This might sound odd, but more experimental kind of work. Hmm. So, in researching When We Dead Awaken, I discovered that Ibsen and the artist Edvard Munch had a friendship, and that Munch made over 400 illustrations of Ibsen's plays.
Ah.
And Munch being the famous painter of the Scream, mm-hmm. exactly. And so I thought, well, that's a fascinating friendship. What if, since When We Dead Awaken is a very different play anyway, what if we set this entire play in a Munchian environment? Oh. So everything in the set is covered in fabric that has been treated and painted with that style, that expressionistic style of wow. Edvard Munch. So, you know, not swirling, but kind of no hard lines, you know,
right,
everything
right.
is, so the grass is made out of many different colors, and mm-hmm. the mountains are fabric that are hung from the battens of the theater's ceiling.
Wow.
And so what that allowed for was, so for example, you have these operatic and almost cinematic moments in this play, like the river, for example, when they're talking about their past and they're throwing roses into the water. Well, this lent itself perfectly, because I thought, one of the first thoughts I had was, well, if we go with a Munch kind of design, that means the river can be fabric, mm. which means the river can move through the space, which means the audience can then watch these flowers be flowing downstage.
Wow.
Right? And it also opened up lots of opportunity for what this avalanche could be at the end, as opposed to just a massive sound cue and then go crazy with the lights. Maybe we could come up with something much more theatrically interesting. Because in the play, Ibsen has all of this stage direction that he gives you, which is utterly unhelpful, because it's almost as if he's describing a scene from a film.
Mm.
You know, in the distance we see Rubek and Irene carried aloft on the snow of the avalanche. Well, yeah, good luck figuring that one out,
right?
In a black box theater,
sure.
or a proscenium. You know,
well, and it's interesting. I mean, good luck doing that back in right. 1890
exactly.
or whenever, and good luck even today. I mean, even with all we can do,
yep.
I mean, still, that is
beyond
the capability of most companies.
Yeah,
so.
How on earth do you create an avalanche?
Wow.
So so that once I lit upon that, and then in talking and plotting and planning with my wonderful colleagues of how we could best utilize the space, and with the three-act structure within these 90 minutes. So the first act takes place mostly in one section of the black box, and then the second act takes place in the midsection of that playing space, and the final act takes place in the mountains, which is kind of the third quadrant or section of, you know, and just having fun with the conceptual nature, which I think lends itself well to this play.
You know, I was astonished when you said that this was 90 minutes long, because mm-hmm. just to look at the synopsis, I love short plays. I mean,
right.
Doubt by John Patrick Stanley is my very favorite play. And part of it is, I mean, among many things, is I just love that sense of leaving you wanting more.
Right. Yep.
And so the last thing I expected for you to say was that this is a short play.
Right.
I mean, all that's packed into 90 minutes. It's just astounding to me.
Yeah, and you know, the students and I have talked a lot about that. The student actors of, you know, it's not like it's Ibsen light. You know, it is Ibsen in a more compact, more streamlined. You know, I mean, he accomplished everything he set out to accomplish in this new form. You know,
wow.
it's really a wonderful play, and I think it is a little shocking. It is surprising. It's funny, which a lot of his plays are, but nobody will tell you that.
Right.
And it is packed with theatricality, and I think audiences will really have a good time and be very surprised.
Hmm. He, of course, was Norwegian.
Mm-hmm.
I assume this play originally was in Norwegian?
Yes.
Yeah. So are there various translations from which to choose, or is there basically just one translation?
There are. We went for an older translation that still resonated really well. It makes things easier with production because we don't have to pay for the rights.
Mm.
There's any number of translations. And some of his plays, because I directed Hedda Gabler years ago at Parkside, and I came across one script that was, I think, had just been released, and it was incredible. And we tried to get the rights to it, and you know, we're like, yeah, nice try. It's going to be produced at the National Theatre in London, you know, kind of a thing. And it was like, But so, you know, the translations can vary wildly. So it's just a matter of finding the one that has that kind of musicality and that sense that it doesn't sound stilted or doesn't sound like a quote unquote Ibsen play.
Sure. A couple facets of the story intrigue me. One of them is that when we meet this sculptor, we also meet his wife, Maya, and that they, at that point in time, are both, it would seem, rather disappointed in life and in some ways disappointed in each other and disappointed in their marriage. And at least the way this synopsis was summarized, that felt very current, very authentic in a way that, you know, sometimes in the world of theater, things are very, like, hyper-dramatic.
Right.
A marriage is disintegrating before our eyes. And this isn't that.
No.
This is just a man and a wife kind of tired of each other.
Yeah, they're just kind of tired of each other.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose in some ways that's maybe a hint of this kind of realism that you were talking about.
Yeah, that there's... there's no, you know, they're not fighting. They're not, you know, they're pretty much, they're square with each other all the time. You know, she's bored. He knows she's bored. He just wants to read his newspaper. She won't shut up. She wants attention. He wants to, you know, go for a walk, you know, but there's never a case of the dramatics of, you know, we're ruined. This marriage is over. It's just kind of like, well, you know, we got a big house. We can probably live there and not run into each other too much.
Just, and things are just kind of winding down.
And of course, pragmatic.
Yes, but then you insert into that this charismatic figure who was his model for this amazing sculpture. And she's like this figure from we don't know where.
Right.
And that juxtaposition is so fascinating to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we find out in the play that she just vanishes. She leaves him. And they both, it seems, spent years trying to find each other. And then all of a sudden she is there, and she's in the care of this kind of sinister nun. One of the characters refers to her as the Black Crow. And she's, you know, she's clearly disturbed, and then you discover that she is convinced that she has been dead for all these years. And in the actual play, were I to cast this in the professional realm, the other realm that I inhabit, the professional theater, these characters are, I mean, Rubeck would be in his 70s and Maya would be, you know, in her late 40s, and Irene would be pushing 60, and, you know. And so the first thing I did was go through the script and find all of the age references and things like that. And I told the actors, I said, this is not going to be a group of 21-year-old student actors with white shoe polish in their hair kind of a show. I refuse. I will not do that.
Yeah.
So we played the honesty of the relationships. So and that was fascinating. And I think it works. You know, it's just relationships.
And I trust that the students who were so excited about this play being chosen are equally excited, if not more so now.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the students is the costume designer. And Kaylin has been has been great, and she's so excited about working on the costumes, and they're beautiful, really beautiful work. And then Jenna, the stage manager, has just had a smile on her face throughout the entire process, and has done a great job.
Fantastic.
With wrangling all the cats and keeping me on task.
How large a cast?
It is a cast of five.
Okay.
And then we've got a couple of deck crew that function as wait staff.
There you
for the spa.
So the play again is When We Dead Awaken by Henrik Ibsen, his final drama. And if you want information about tickets, and performances are this coming weekend and the following weekend, so March 1, 2, 3, and 8, 9, 10, you can go to box office at uwp.edu, or you can call the Parkside box office at 262-595-2564, 595-2564. And we do want to remind you as well that this production is being performed in Parkside's marvelous black box theater. I mean, it is just a space to behold, even apart from whatever play is being presented. In this case, Ibsen's When We Dead Awaken. Brian Gill, its director. Brian Gill, wonderful to catch up with you again. Thank you for being here to tell the story of this fascinating play and production, and best wishes to you, your cast, and crew.
Thank you, Greg. It's always a joy to see you.
And to finish out the Wednesday morning show here on WGTD, we're going to be talking about a special event that is going to be presented under the auspices of the Milwaukee Opera Theater, which likes to bill itself as Milwaukee's microbrewery for opera. And for those of you who have had some encounter with Milwaukee Opera Theater, you know that they do a whole lot of interesting things, operatically speaking, and often in interesting spaces. And in many respects, it's a way to capture opera in more intimate settings and in more intimate experiences, and often very contemporary works that speak very powerfully to the time in which we live. What is coming up next from Milwaukee Opera Theater is actually a cabaret titled I Wanna Fly. And it is billed as an old-fashioned cabaret with a new-fashioned Milwaukee Opera Theater angle. So this is maybe not your mother's or your grandmother's cabaret, but a cabaret conceived with the 21st century in mind. And I'm very excited to be able to speak for the next few minutes over the telephone with Lynette Knapp Ryan, who is the singer in the spotlight for this cabaret, with pianist David Bonifilio, and a couple of special guests who are also going to be along as well. And we will be talking with her about how she has put this evening together, and what people who can expect who will be taking in one of the performances. It opens tomorrow night, February 29th, and runs through the 3rd of March at the Florentine Opera Center in Milwaukee. And Lynette Knapp Ryan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to be talking with you. And over the years, we've had a few interesting conversations with people affiliated with Milwaukee Opera Theater. And certainly I admire the intriguing and often groundbreaking things that this company has done. I think before we go any further, it might be interesting for our listeners to find out a little bit about you and where you come from. I don't know a lot about your life and career, but I do know that you grew up on a dairy farm in New York State. And so there's some resonance there, of course, with the state of Wisconsin. Tell us more about where life has taken you, and in particular, musically, where life has taken you.
Absolutely. I grew up in upstate New York, Fabius. It's near Syracuse, New York, central area, I guess, of New York. And I just have always loved opera, musical theater, singers, lyricists, musicians, composers. And I don't know how, but I just decided from like the age of 11 that I needed to do this for my life. And my family could not have been more supportive. I don't think they knew what they had on their hands, but they were like, this is what she needs to do. And I went to a state school, Fredonia University, near Buffalo, New York. Snow, as much as you could imagine. And then from there, I jumped to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where I got a BFA in musical theater. I minored in opera with as many things as I possibly could get under my belt without actually getting a degree. And then jumped to Chicago, where I just started doing musical theater, and then ended up in Switzerland because Phantom of the Opera was going to open a new production there. And I lived there for 2 years, so I got to experience kind of a little bit more of an operatic Phantom of the Opera. There were opera singers from maybe 15 different countries in the show. It was incredible. So many languages buzzing around me all the time, which I loved. And then I decided to head to New York, and I lived there for about 8 years, on and off, mostly off because I was traveling to regional theaters all around the country. Wherever they would pay me to go, I would go sing, and got to perform Celia and A Funny Thing Happened in the Way in the Forum. I got to understudy a lot of roles. I toured the United States with the Phantom of the Opera as well, understudying Christine with that, and got to do Marion and the Music Man. Really classical musical theater, too, was kind of my home as the ingenue. And then, so I never stopped moving. Just constantly, we went to Philly, and then we went to Florida, where we got a gig there, and then we went to Washington, and then we ended up in Milwaukee, where I've kind of been trying to figure out who I am as a singer, as a performer, for the last maybe 6 years. And because I'm no longer the ingenue, I am a whole new woman, a whole new character. So, and so that kind of is where I have been with getting this show kind of put together. I don't know if that helps a little bit about who I am.
Absolutely. Something else I read about this event is that since coming to the area that you have devoted the last maybe almost decade or so in large measure to being a mom and also teaching fitness. I mean, that in some respects, singing has not been as central a focus as it had been there through some tiring years of touring and so on. So is that an apt description of the last few years? And so is this, in a sense, kind of a coming out party or a return of sorts?
Yep, and finding my voice at this age and my view on things. I'm still singing musical theater songs that people might know, but now it's from someone who has lived this many years. You know, there's such different stories now, and my voice is, grown and changed, and I've been working like an athlete, for years trying to get back into, what do I feel like now in this body? And it's been, Milwaukee Opera Theater has this amazing one night almost every month called Voice Lab. And anyone can come and sing. You just sign up 2 weeks ahead of time. You get your slot as fast as you can. You email as soon as you see it go up. And you can try out new songs. You can do a monologue. You can, so you get lots of opera singers that are out of this world. Amazing. Just jaw-dropping. Working on roles for shows or auditions. And then the musical theater people, we kind of sneak in there too. We're in there. And then songwriters are in there kind of trying out their songs. There's only 10 spots each time. So even if you just go and listen, there's so much to absorb, and you're just in the room with the right people, who are doing the same thing you're doing. And that is not a thing that happens anywhere. People don't have this opportunity. And Milwaukee Opera Theater has created this, and Joanna Ponasek is just created this environment where people can just explore who they are at this point in their lives.
Sounds perfect for you. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Lynette Knapp Ryan on the eve of the first performance of her cabaret called I Wanna Fly, being presented under the auspices of the Milwaukee Opera Theater, with performances beginning tomorrow night, February 29th through the 3rd of March. So maybe just for a moment, let's not take too long, but let's give you a chance to kind of summarize for our listeners what we're talking about when we mean a cabaret, and then the way in which this cabaret is maybe conceived in a different way than maybe cabarets of the past.
Absolutely. So with traditional cabaret, it's song, story, personal stories, or they can choose a lyricist and do, you know, all Cole Porter songs, you know, and give a little bit of history of Cole Porter or why he wrote this song, and then you sing a couple songs, and you're talking right to the audience. They are right there. There's no fourth wall, which they, you know, in musical theater there is. You create this environment and you stay in it the whole entire show. This is me and, or any performer, is very traditional cabaret, and the people in the audience, they get to look me in the eyes, and I'm going to look right back at them and sing these songs, which, you know, and again, they're from musicals most of the time. A lot of times people just write cabaret songs, which happen to be kind of story songs. So that's traditional. What we're doing is we are starting with Maury Yeston's December Song Cycle. So it's December songs he wrote as traditional cabaret with a little classical song cycle style. So it is sung straight through, and it is a character. She begins and rolls through her story until 35 minutes later. So it is that is the twist for MOT. That's the first 35 minutes. The second set is maybe 55 minutes, I'd say. And I have a couple guests come on and sing, and that is definitely traditional cabaret, where I tell a little story about my life, sing a little set of three songs that kind of like group into that world from musical theater, and then I tell another story, and then I continue from there, and then I bring on guests, and then we're at the end. It's kind of lovely.
I have read someplace that in terms of the specifics, in terms of the specific repertoire that you're going to be offering up, you and your pianist David Bonifilio, that we're talking about maybe a couple of years in terms of the slow, careful, meticulous assemblage of this particular array of songs. Take us inside that process, and what has that been like, and has it sort of taken shape and then been disassembled and things discarded, or has it just been kind of a slow, steady build to now this complete program?
Wow. Yeah, it has been so fun. And when people say enjoy the journey, this is exactly what we have done. David is phenomenal at the piano and so knowledgeable about musical theater and the world. And we just connected so well. And we have been working on different songs and different ways and styles to do them, where they're not just, you know, taken out of a musical and the character sings a song. It's me as Lynette singing the song about my life. So it's a little bit of a different concept. And so the two of us have kind of like just gone through piece by piece and gone, I don't know if that works. It does, but we have too many similar to that. Let's get rid of that one. And then start with another one and go, oh my God, we have to keep this. We have to do this one, you know? And also we wanted a vocal range too. So we've got talky songs. We've got comedy songs. We have soprano, you know, anthem songs. It's just been an incredible journey. And every time he comes over, we just tell stories, which is cabaret. We tell stories, sing a little, tell a few more stories to each other. And it's kind of developed the show over the years, and on purpose, too. This is why we have been getting together. And this is the path of the journey, was to get here.
Mm. So if one were to go to this more than once, that is to more than one of these upcoming performances, How identical would those performances be? I guess that's a roundabout way of asking how, in a sense, carefully and precisely scripted is this cabaret? Fairly tight and meticulous and unchanging. Not that that would anything be wrong with that, but or do you anticipate this being a little more freewheeling, where you respond to the moment and to what you sort of feel like each time?
Well, I am a serious practicer, so. You know, and that's why I love that we took so long to do it, so that we could just put it in our pockets and say, we own this material. Now, what happens when we add these human beings? You know, and that's what cabaret is. It's so in the moment of, you know, this is for them. I want them to experience all these moments and take them on my journey, but also trigger things in their mind that go, yeah, this is my journey too. Oh my goodness. You know? So it will evolve and change every single night. That's a little scary. I'm not going to lie, for someone who just loves doing my characters in my shows, but I'm at this age where it's hard to find the roles. There are so few for people, of my type and age, and that this is an opportunity that Milwaukee Opera Theater has given me, and I don't even know how to thank them. I'm so grateful to get to do all of this material for an audience.
Tell our listeners about the space, I mean the specific stage on which you will be performing that, and to what extent that is a familiar space to you. Or maybe newly familiar. I assume you've been doing plenty of rehearsal on that stage in anticipation of tomorrow night's opening.
Yeah. It is the idea with cabaret, too, is that it's very intimate. And a casual setting, you want people to feel really comfortable. So it is petite. It is a rehearsal space for Florentine Opera Center. And we have created a little maybe intimate lighting, not necessarily stage lighting. The stage is not higher than the audience, so I am right there with them. I do sing with a microphone, so that is a little bit different probably than the space has always been used for. There's a lot of opera singing going on in there. And the chairs are close. There's only 45, 50 maybe 60 seats in there. We'll see. I have Le Rev Patisserie and Cafe is another job that I have, and they are supplying wine, beer, water, so people can have a little sip of something while they just sit back and relax or lean in and participate. We'll see. So it's intimate. It's lovely. And I'm very excited that this is our space.
Fantastic. So it opens tomorrow night, that is Thursday, February 29th, 7:30 p.m., March 1st and 2nd also, 7:30 p.m., and March 3rd, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the following weekend, I believe, March 9th and 10th, 9th at 7:30, March 10th at 2 o'clock. If people are interested in purchasing tickets, what do they do?
They can go online to MilwaukeeOperaTheater.org. Or they can call 917-684-0512 to order tickets. We are sold out for Sunday already. We're just a couple short of being sold out for Friday night. Same with the next weekend. That Sunday is going really quick, but Saturday nights are available for sure, which is kind of fun.
Very good. Well, it's a lovely problem to have. We're glad that there are so many people interested in taking this in. And, of course, the Milwaukee Opera Theater has a sterling reputation for presenting only the very, very best in opera and musical theater on kind of an intimate scale. And this cabaret called I Wanna Fly opens tomorrow night at the Florentine Opera Center. And Lynette Knapp Ryan, thank you so much for making time for this conversation. It's great to get acquainted. I hope we get to meet in person sometime. And I hope a lot of people will seek out what sounds like a very intriguing and entertaining and moving cabaret presentation. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning.